This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, journalist Dexter Filkins, spent several weeks in Yemen covering the protest movement that is demanding President Ali Abdullah Saleh leave office. As inspiring as this youthful movement is, counter-terrorist experts in the U.S. are worried that if chaos follows Saleh's departure, al-Qaeda fighters in Yemen would be freer to plan attacks on America. Filkins' article, After the Uprising, Can Protesters Find a Path Between Dictatorship and Anarchy?, is published in the current edition of The New Yorker. Before joining The New Yorker in December, Filkins covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan for The New York Times. His war reporting won a George Polk Award. His book, The Forever War, won a National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. Dexter Filkins was in a studio in Istanbul when we recorded our interview this morning. Dexter Filkins, welcome back to Fresh Air. Thank you for joining us from Istanbul. So of all the Middle East revolutions, why did you choose to go to Yemen and cover the uprising there?
I don't know. It's a very, very interesting, complicated, unbelievably complicated, but also important place. If you remember, I mean, we'll obviously talk about the revolution, but, you know, two attacks in the past year and a half or 2 years have come out of Yemen, two attacks by al-Qaeda into the United States. There was, or, you know, they were planned there or they originated there in some way. And so there's this kind of very direct kind of Western interest in the place, in addition to the fact that it's caught up in a pretty thrilling and wonderful way. It's caught up in the middle of, you know, the Arab awakening. And they're trying to overthrow a leader who is repressive and has been in power for 33 years when most of this country was not even alive. I mean, this is a very young country. So it's really interesting. I mean, there's just a lot going on there. But I think what distinguishes it is that there really is this kind of direct American interest and engagement in it. It's not just kind of theoretical or, we're worried about Egypt becoming, you know, this or that if Mubarak falls. This is very, very direct because there's a pretty active al-Qaeda phenomenon in the countryside.
And there seems to be some direct connections for you between Yemen and other countries you've reported on. For example, you reported on the Iraq War for years, and you say that Saddam Hussein was Yemen's President Saleh's mentor. What was their relationship?
Well, I think it was mentor to protege. But I mean, it was fascinating. I went to a couple of rallies that President Saleh had in Yemen just recently. I mean, just as recently as a couple of weeks ago, he was having. I mean, as the anti-government demonstrations were unfolding and as they were growing, I mean, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, he was kind of rallying. He was. Concocting his own demonstrations. And so he would stage these enormous rallies that were essentially celebrations of himself. And it was as if you were in a time capsule and you woke up and you were in Baghdad under Saddam Hussein in 1995 or something. I mean, it just felt like a bath party rally. The flags look exactly the same. So it was a bunch of senior Arab leaders standing on an elevated platform wearing Ray-Bans and listening to people cheer to them, how much they loved them and adored them and how willing they were to sacrifice their souls and their lives for this regime. And it was completely staged. I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, if it didn't feel like a bath party rally, it would feel like I guess the other metaphor would be, you know, the Supreme Soviet in 1936 or something. I mean, something Stalin would be very familiar with. But here's a crowd of 50,000 people, you know, just screaming, adoringly at the leader. And, of course, they were all being paid. And all being fed.
How do you know they're
the
all being paid? How did you
they told us? I mean, they. And actually, this is a really funny aside, which didn't make it into the story. But I went to a kind of pro-government rally, and it kind of went as it was supposed to go, and everybody was supposed to be paid who had been there. And then apparently, and I say apparently because I couldn't quite nail it down, although I think it did happen. some of these people didn't get paid, and so they started chanting the anti-government slogans as if they were, you know, down at the university demanding the president's ouster. As soon as they discovered they weren't going to be paid, they turned against the government. But but the Ba'ath Party connection, I mean, there really was a direct connection between Saddam and Saleh, so direct that Yemen in 1990, just before the Gulf War started in 1991, Yemen was the only Arab state that voted against the UN resolution to expel Saddam by force from Kuwait. And so they suffered, their economy just suffered catastrophically because of that vote.
What was the connection?
The connection, I think it was on the order of about 1 million Yemenis were working in different places in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, places like that. And they were expelled by Saudi Arabia. All the countries that were basically supporting the UN resolution to expel Saddam expelled when the Yemeni government voted against the resolution, they expelled all the Yemenis. And so that was 1 million people who had been, you know, working in relatively well-paying jobs and bringing money home. So they really took a hit for that. But that's how strong the connection was.
One other thing I want to ask you about the pro-Saleh rally that you attended in Yemen. When he was introduced, you quote the introduction, and the introducer says, "Ladies and gentlemen, the president of all the Yemeni people, the preserver of unity, savior of the nation, peace be upon him, His Excellency Ali Abdullah Saleh." It sounds like the kind of intro James Brown used to get.
Yeah. Well, I was lucky that day. I went to this rally. It was in the big, I think it's called like the, I don't know, the Stadium of the Revolution. And I just had a very favored spot. I was up on the viewing stand, and it was really hard for me to get there. But I was basically, you know, at some point I was, you know, 2 feet from the president himself. So, yeah, I got to see it all very, very up close, including him. It was pretty exciting.
So my guest is Dexter Filkins. He covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan for The New York Times. He's now with The New Yorker. His article in the current edition of The New Yorker is about Yemen. Now, so we were talking about the pro-government rally that you attended. You also met with the woman who basically organized the opposition. And you should pronounce her name for me.
Her name is Tawakkol Karman.
Tawakkol Karman. Now, what's her background and what was her motivation for organizing the protest movement?
Well, I should just say, you know, she's just an extraordinary person. I mean, you go to a country like this, maybe somebody like me, if you drop into a country like this, which kind of exists out of time, it's a closed society. It's not open by any means. It's the status of women there is, you know, centuries behind the West. I mean, women wear, you know, head to toe chadors. They're everything but their eyes. You don't really see women at all on the streets. And somehow you meet a person and you're just kind of amazed. And I said this to her when I met Tawakkol, the leader of the movement. I said, "How did you happen? how did you turn out this way? You know, and it is an amazing thing." And so, she's a very interesting one. But she, on the first night. On the first night of the first Arab Revolution in Tunisia, which was January 14th, I think on the next night, she and like 10 other people went out to the square in front of Sani University and started to demonstrate and started just initially to praise the Tunisian Revolution. And 10 people on the first night. And so on the next night, it was 50 people. And then the night after that, it was 300. And then, you know, a week later, it was 1,000. And then she was arrested, put in jail for 3 days. The demonstrations kept going. They decided to let her go. And here we are, you know, there are days, I think last Friday, there were probably more than 1 million people demonstrating. And it started with 10 people. So it was just extraordinary. But she, not to go on too long, but she, I met her at her house. And afterwards, you know, one night at 11 o'clock or something. And what was really striking was you know, in trying to answer this question, how did you come to be? On her kind of mantle, there were four framed pictures, and it was Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, Hillary Clinton, and Martin Luther King. And she was fascinating because she said to me, you know, for the last couple of years, the last 3 years or so, you know, every change that she sought, she would demonstrate, she and other people would demonstrate in front of the president's palace, and they would demand kind of, you know, to release this journalist or for more press freedom or whatever. And she said, you know, and then I saw the president of Tunisia fall, and it hit me like a lightning bolt, you know. The whole regime has to go. And so she headed for the square.
No, obviously a lot of the demonstrators are men. It's a country in which women take a very background kind of role in things, in public life. So yes. How do the men who are demonstrating react to her as a leader?
Well, that's a great question. Somebody had mentioned Tawakkul to me pretty early on after I got there, and I got there kind of in early, mid-February. And the demonstration is still pretty small. And so I was just, you know, looking around trying to figure out what was going on. And someone said to me, you got to find Tawakkul Carmen. She's one of the leaders, you know, she's a woman. And so I had a hard time finding her. I didn't have her phone number. And I was out there one night at the demonstrations, and it was like 10 o'clock at night. And there were maybe 1,000 people there. It wasn't really big. And suddenly, you know, in this ocean of men, this woman climbs up on the stage and grabs the microphone and starts calling for the downfall of the regime, and the people want the regime to fall. And so right when Tawakkul jumped up on the stage, you could just see the men kind of look at each other and go, you know, who's that? But they followed her, you know, and she was completely, I mean, she didn't miss a beat. I mean, it's a weird thing because you go to these demonstrations, they've changed a little, but 99% of the people at these demonstrations are men. You know, there might be 100 women and 15,000 men, you know, and one of the leaders is a woman, and they follow her. So it's pretty extraordinary.
While you were in Yemen, Carmen was arrested and detained for 36 hours. She was released unharmed, but there was a threat delivered to her through her brother. Would you explain what the threat was and what that has to say about the regime's method of delivering the message to people that they're in danger?
Well, the first thing I should say probably is that, and I talked about this with Tawakkul, is that Yemen is a repressive government, but it is not, it's not a kind of nightmarish government. It's not Gaddafi's Libya. It's not as repressive as Saudi Arabia. It's kind of sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. And it's not uniformly draconian. So there's a little bit of space, you know. She felt, you know, free to criticize him freely and say basically whatever she wanted. In fact, she joked about it at one point. She said, you know, the thing about this country is you can say whatever you want, but nothing ever changes. but she went out there on January 15th. She started to demonstrate, she and 10 other people. And the demonstration started to grow. And then she was arrested by these plain-clothed, you know, creepy guys, no IDs, no nothing, taken away. Now, you know, she could have never been heard from again, frankly. I mean, that's happened in that country. They held her for 3 days, and for reasons that aren't really clear, they let her go. And, I don't know if somebody intervened on her behalf, whether the Americans did or whatever, but they let her go. And then again, a kind of odd thing about this country and the regime is, and you see this in other countries, that, you know, there's so few elites that they all tend to know each other, even if they don't like each other. And so the president, President Saleh, passed a message to Tawakkul's brother, who is a poet, whose name is Tariq, and he was kind of a pro-president guy. And he said, look, nobody disobeys me, and control your sister. And if you don't, I'm going to kill her. And Tariq dutifully passed the message on to his sister. I think he, Tariq, broke with the president at that moment. And Tawakkul just kept right on going. So pretty amazing. And I think the last I heard, Tariq was composing anti-government poetry and reading it aloud at the demonstration. So it's strange. I mean, she definitely had a death threat. Demonstrators have been shot and killed in the streets. But it's unpredictable. You know, it's just you just don't know on whether the government's going to be nice today or nasty.
Is there a disagreement in the protest movement over whether to include the Islamist party in Yemen? And, you know, the Islamists in Yemen, that's one of the really big concerns of the United States, because al-Qaeda has a big presence in Yemen, and there have been al-Qaeda-initiated attacks on the United States that came from Yemen, that originated in Yemen.
Yes, there is that. I mean, that was a pretty live issue when I was there. And I should sort of step back. People said to me, you know, 100 times when I was in Yemen, they said, look, Yemen, you have to remember, Yemen is not Egypt. It's not Tunisia. It doesn't have a middle class. It doesn't have an intelligentsia. It doesn't have those things. It's basically a rural society. You know, most of the people live in the countryside. Most of the population is very, very young. It's uneducated. It's illiterate. So, and it's deeply, deeply conservative. So in a place like Egypt, where you have just this kind of giant middle class that's super educated and exposed to the West and kind of shares a lot of the values with us, that's not necessarily true in Yemen. So what you had, and what was a pretty, you know, it was. I never really worked it out of my head, and I don't think they've worked it out either. But you had the demonstrations in the beginning were led mostly by the students and by young people. And these are, you know, really educated, privileged, smart, sophisticated kids. And they knew what they wanted. And people like Tawakkul. I mean, they basically want what we want. You know, they want freedom and democracy and a free press and all the things that they've been denied. And what's strange is what's been difficult, or kind of, I think, difficult for them, but kind of strange to witness, is that as the movement has gotten more popular, and it certainly has, it's become a popular movement. There's these tensions with the rest of the society, which is basically very, very conservative and very religious. And that includes the Islamists. And there's an Islamist party there. And I was there, I mentioned this in the piece, there was this extraordinary moment when a guy named Abdul-Majid al-Zindani, who's an imam and a cleric, and he got up and spoke in front of the students. I mean, you know, in that day, there must have been 10,000 people. There was a huge crowd, and, you know, kind of a stir went through the crowd. And he got up on the stage, and he started to speak, and he said, the caliphate is coming. You know, the caliphate is coming. And very Islamist speech. And so it was the first time I'd seen that. And then after that speech, I just by chance, because, again, this is in a sea of people, I happened to see Tawakkul, who's not Islamist at all and, you know, was pretty secular in her outlook. She's a woman. She's a liberal. I saw her, and she was furious. You know, she said, we had a big fight about this, you know, the rest of the leaders and I, over whether to allow Zindani to speak. And she said, I was against it. You know, this is not a religious movement. This is a youth movement. It's secular. And so you can see the tensions kind of already coming to the fore.
So are there people within the movement who think the Islamists should be included? I guess so, if they let Zindani speak.
Well, yeah, but I think it's even bigger than that. I think it's that the movement itself, as it becomes more popular, it necessarily becomes more religious, more Islamist, because that's the way society is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I think it's going to be, you know, if I don't like to predict the future, but because it's usually not a good idea, but. I'll put it this way. I'm concerned that the people like Tawakkul, the liberals, you know, small L, the people who generally have a secular outlook and want to have a kind of secular state, I'm worried that they're going to get pushed aside as the movement becomes more of a mass movement. It will become more Islamist almost necessarily.
And if it becomes more Islamist, does that leave the door open to al-Qaeda to have a more official place at the table?
I don't know. I mean, personally, I think when you look at the revolutions that are sweeping the Arab world, whether it's in Yemen or Egypt or anywhere else, I think I mean, I think it's a catastrophe for al-Qaeda. I mean, I think, you know, they've thrived on these closed, repressive societies for years. And now suddenly the fresh air and the sunlight are coming in. And I think they're in trouble. So I don't think they're going to get a seat at the table that way. But I do think they – al-Qaeda thrives on chaos and despair. And you know, there's certainly no shortage of that in Yemen.
What are some of the options that the Obama administration sees when they look into the future of Yemen?
I think they're all bad. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, here's the problem. You've had a guy in power for so long, 33 years, you know, 1978. I mean, you know, Jimmy Carter was president in 1978. He's been in power for so long and that he has gutted and basically hollowed out every institution in that country. So in reference to the government and to the armed forces, he's hollowed out those institutions and replaced them with, you know, his family and cronies. And so you have, I think, 27 or 28 family members spread throughout the government. So his son is the head of the Republican Guards. You know, his nephew is the head of the Mukhabarat. I mean, you just go, you know, he is another relative who's head of the oil ministry. Another one who's the head of the national airline. I mean, it's just one thing after another. So it's just a big, giant family business. And so if you get rid of the family, you get rid of the state, and then it all falls apart. And so that's what they're wrestling with. It's like, look, if we get rid of the Saleh family and the whole clan, how can we devise something that will prevent the state from completely collapsing, you know, and that's not easy. And I think it's why it's kind of taken. I mean, this has been a very slow motion revolution in Yemen. You know, I mean, this has been going on for 2 months now. People have been demonstrating in the streets.
And Yemen is a particularly important place in terms of the United States safety because it's a home to so many members of al-Qaeda. And it's interesting that the president of Yemen has been helpful officially to the United States in the campaign against al-Qaeda. And the United States has bombed al-Qaeda sites in Yemen. And there was some kind of deal made where Saleh said that the U.S. could bomb, but he would take credit for the bombings.
Yes.
He told Petraeus that the U.S. could continue missile strikes against al-Qaeda as long as the Yemeni government could take credit for them. That was a revelation from WikiLeaks. So is he playing both sides? Because on the one hand, he's allowed his country to be a home to many al-Qaeda cells. And at the same time, he's allowing the United States to bomb al-Qaeda.
Well, I think the most generous interpretation to Saleh, and I'm not sure I would endorse that, but I think the most generous interpretation is he presides over an extremely weak state, and so al-Qaeda thrives, you know, outside the reach of the state, and he can't stop them, he can't control them, so he's decided to allow the United States a great deal of latitude in attacking al-Qaeda. The problem there, and this is true across that part of the world, you know, whether it's Karzai or you know, the Saudis or somebody else, the United States isn't popular. So if the word gets out, and it has gotten out, you can never keep these things secret. But I think the idea is if it is known that the Yemeni government is allowing the United States to bomb and fire missiles at targets in Yemen, which often miss their targets and kill the wrong people, that will be really, really hurtful and harmful to the Yemeni government. So you have this bizarre shorthand going on, which was in the WikiLeaks cables, which is hilarious, you know, where Saleh is saying to Petraeus, you know, look, you keep bombing and I'll keep saying we did it. So, and there's all sorts of weird, you know, weird bits of dialogue like that. But it's very, very complicated. And I'll just give you one example. Of what's happened there, and it's, you know, it's like out of a spy novel. But last May, there was an American strike. I think it was a Predator drone strike, fired at some al-Qaeda people outside of the capital of Sana'a. It hit its target. It killed some al-Qaeda people. It also happened to kill the deputy governor of a province, of Marib province. His name is Shindani. And it killed the deputy governor. And so within, you know, within hours, people in Yemen knew that there was a they knew that there had been a strike, an airstrike, probably an American strike. I mean, every taxi driver in town knows. And so I had a conversation with an American official in Washington about this very strike. And I said, look, you know, you looks like you killed some of the people you wanted to, but then you killed the deputy governor. And it backfired on the Yemeni government, and they went crazy, and they've stopped allowing the United States to do these strikes. And the answer that came back from this very senior American official was, well, the deputy governor was killed because he's part of Al-Qaeda. He said that's not uncommon. You have many parts of the Yemeni government in the local areas have relationships with Al-Qaeda. And so that's how complicated it is. I mean, it is just really, really complicated. But anyway, the end result of that strike, which was in May of last year, that was May of 2010, so almost a year ago, was Saleh basically said to the United States, no more. You know, we can't. These are too politically difficult for me. You guys are dropping your bombs and you're killing. You know, you killed one of my deputy governors, so we can't allow it anymore. And so, they're not allowing the Americans to do anything. And then when you talk to the Americans about what the Yemeni government is doing, the Yemeni government's not doing anything against Al Qaeda. They go to the Yemenis. The Americans do. They go to the Yemenis. They give them targeting information. They give them maps. They say, here's a list of names. Go take these people out. Yemeni government doesn't do anything. And so the bottom line is, for the past 11 months, basically, almost a year, you've had almost no counterterrorist operations going on against al-Qaeda in Yemen.
Meanwhile, last year, 2010, the Defense Department spent $150 million to train and arm Yemeni security forces. Are there fears in the Obama administration, in the U.S. military, that those weapons could be turned against us or against the demonstrators?
I think it's the latter. I think it's the latter. I had a lot of conversations about the training program that we're doing. We're providing them with helicopters, night vision goggles, weapons, you know, training, all sorts of stuff. And the first complaint of the Americans, I mean, I talked to this one guy who was involved in the program, and he said, look, you know, I can't tell you the number of times that we've gone to the president, President Saleh, and we've put information on his desk, and we've said, here are the bad guys, go get them. And he says, thanks, you know, and then nothing happens. And he said, you know, we just can't get him to do anything. And so long pause. And he said, you know, if he's not using these guys that we're training against the bad guys, what's he want them for? And he said, you know, my concern is that, you know, we're training this whole big force to basically protect the warden. That's how he put it, protect the president. And so the American officials in Yemen say, we have drawn very bright red lines and said to President Saleh, you cannot under any circumstances use these troops, these counterterrorism troops, against, say, nonviolent demonstrators. You cannot do that. And the moment you do that, we will leave. We will pull the plug on the program. There are suspicions that they are, but at this point, they're just that, just suspicions.
Do you see parallels between Yemen and Pakistan? In terms of the ambiguity of the government's position on al-Qaeda?
Yes, I do. I do. I mean, you know, the Pakistan one is pretty well known, you know, unbelievably complicated. But essentially, you have, you know, the United States providing, you know, more than $1 billion a year in aid to the Pakistani government, which to fight the Taliban largely. And simultaneously, the Pakistani government it becomes clearer and clearer each day. It's helping the Taliban against the United States. So it's kind of very, very complicated double game. I don't think it's that pronounced in Yemen. But when you talk to people, when you talk to people, I mean, there is a bit of a, I don't know if double game is the right way, but somebody put it to me this way. They said, you know, for us, to Saleh, to President Saleh, the Americans, al-Qaeda, you know, we're just a couple more tribes he has to deal with. You know, this is a tribal society, and he's constantly balancing one tribe against the other. And he said, you know, al-Qaeda's a tribe, and, like, the Americans are a tribe. So he's just playing everybody off against everybody else, with the ultimate aim, of course, of keeping himself in power.
So you describe Yemen as a very tribal culture, and you met with one of the powerful leaders of a tribal group. So tell us about the person who you met with.
Well, his name was Hamid Al-Atmar, and he was really, he was quite a character. I met him in his house, which looks like a castle. I mean, there's 20-foot high sandstone walls. It's, marble floors and kind of gigantic chandeliers, and nothing understated. And his house surrounded by guys with machine guns and, you know, RPGs and a small army. And this is in the middle of, downtown. This is in the middle of the capital. And so I met him. He's Hamid Al-Atmar is an extremely ambitious guy. And if you had to put your money on who would end up in some ways wielding the most power in Yemen after Saleh leaves, it will be Hamid Al-Atmar. Whether he's formally the president, probably not, or something like the vice president, the prime minister or something, he'll be the man in the driver's seat. So I thought it was a good idea to go see him. And I was led into his giant marble palace, and I sat down with him, and quite a character. But I remember he told me this hilarious story about the president himself. And he said, I think that President Saleh had a very unhappy childhood. He said, perhaps the most unhappy childhood in history. And he said, and for his entire life, he's been taking out this unhappy childhood on all of us. And he said, I think the president is never so happy as when he has a very powerful person on his knees in front of him begging for his life. This is what makes the president really happy.
Gosh.
So I couldn't tell. I thought he was joking, but I think he wasn't.
Well, talk about hysterical stories. This person also told you that when Saleh travels to Europe, he's in his 60s, that he carries Viagra in his pocket.
always, yeah. I mean, well, what was really weird about Yemen is there's this whole absolutely bizarre phenomenon of khat, which is this kind of, it's like an evergreen shrub. And every day, probably three quarters of the country stuffs an enormous amount of khat in its mouth, in its cheeks, so that people's cheeks are just kind of bulging like there's a softball in it, and get high. I mean, it's a narcotic plant. So, and this starts at about 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, and then, but so literally by mid-afternoon, most of the country is high. And so, it's not a powerful narcotic, but it's pretty strange. And so everybody kind of goes into this haze for about 6 hours, and then, things start to pick up again in the later in the evening.
It sounds like when you met with this tribal leader, he was chewing cot.
He was chewing cot.
Did that affect the conversation, do you think?
I don't know. I don't know. I guess so. But he had a giant wad of cot in his mouth, but was feeding me, pastries and almonds and things like that on a platter. None for himself. It suppresses the appetite.
Now, you said that if there is change in Yemen, that this tribal leader that you met with will likely be in the driver's seat, whether he's officially an elected leader or not. He could buy power, too. I mean, he's a billionaire in Yemen, which is like the poorest country in the region.
Yes. He runs with the big cell phone company there called Sabafone. And he is a billionaire. The whole money thing in Yemen is so strange. It's like Deep Throat in All the President's Men. He says follow the money. And that's what you have to do in these societies. You have to follow the money to kind of figure out how this society really works. And so you have Hamid Al-Atmar, who's a billionaire. But then you have really one of the strangest kind of social phenomenons I've ever seen, which is you have the Yemeni government and the Saudi government both essentially enacting this enormous system of nationwide bribery. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. They have placed on their payroll most of the tribal leaders in the country. And so, I mean, I talk to tribal leaders about this. And so if you were the head of a tribe or kind of a, even a mid-level leader in one of the big tribes in Yemen, you get a lot of money from the government. And you get a lot of money from the Saudi government. And the purpose of this money, you don't have to really do anything in return except to keep the peace, just kind of keep your people quiet. And that's the way, I mean, again, it's such a It's such a strange society, but that's how the peace has been kept there for so long. Yeah, I mean, that's basically how Saleh has kind of managed it. He's kind of kept the tribal leaders reasonably happy. The rest of the country is impoverished. And the Saudis have kind of, you know, they're concerned about what happens there, too, because it's right on their border. And so they've kind of pitched in as well, you know. And so really strange.
Well, so this could be a recipe for civil war, maybe, like you take away the president, you take away his payments to the tribal leaders. And do the tribal leaders get along or do they fight?
They fight. They fight. And I think that's the concern. You know, somebody said to me, well, more than one person said to me, 70% of, I think, the public revenues in Yemen come from oil. Oil will be gone in 10 years or begin to run out. Most of the water will begin to run out in 10 years. And so in the short term, you know, as Saleh's position in power was threatened, he started to beef up payments to the tribal leaders, and he started to pay them more, and he gave raises to the army, and he gave raises to, you know, this vast public sector that he has. And so the government's running out of money. And so their foreign reserves, I mean, their currency is kind of the real, it's kind of worthless on the international market. So, but their foreign reserves are basically rapidly disappearing. And so one person said to me at one point, well, I think maybe Saleh can make it through this political crisis, but he sure as heck can't make it through the economic crisis, which is coming, you know, in 2 or 3 months when this government runs out of money, basically.
It sounds like things are actually getting very dangerous for the United States in Yemen now. As the government becomes weaker and as the United States, as a longer time elapses in which the United States cannot do strikes against al-Qaeda because it no longer has that agreement with the Yemen government that it can do it, more al-Qaeda fighters are coming to Yemen. According to a report by your former colleague Eric Schmidt in the New York Times, he says there's a small but steady stream of Islamist fighters coming from other countries to Yemen, and that U.S. intelligence says that there's chatter indicating that al-Qaeda in Yemen is planning another attack against the United States.
Yeah, well, I think that's why the U.S. has been so engaged in Yemen. I mean, there's kind of Yemen as Yemen and then Yemen as a potential threat to the West and the United States. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the concern is that if the president falls and there isn't, you know, a very well thought through transition plan, the place will kind of crumble. And, you know, again, al-Qaeda thrives on that. I don't know, you know, if you look back, I think it was, well, the Christmas Day bomber, 2009, that originated in Yemen. I think you had the guy in Texas at Fort Hood who shot all those people. He was said to be inspired by Anwar al-Awlaki, the al-Qaeda-related cleric who is in Yemen as well. So there's a lot of these lines go back to Yemen.
And those postal bombings where there were,
yes,
was it printers with
printer
explosives inside that were shipped to the United States? That originated in Yemen, too.
Yes.
They were shipped from Yemen anyway.
Yes. And so that's the concern. I mean, I think, again, al-Qaeda sort of thrives in these large ungoverned spaces. And so the fear is that as the government gets weaker and as the government disintegrates, which clearly it's doing, I mean, army units have already been pulled out of all sorts of different places. You saw that spectacular thing last week where the ammunition factory exploded. You know, the army had abandoned this giant ammunition factory and then the looters descended on it and then it blew up. It killed 150 people. The fear is that we're going to see more of that because the government is basically disintegrating before this revolution and that al-Qaeda will be able to take advantage of that.
You've been covering the Middle East for a long time. What's your reaction to seeing all of the uprisings in the Middle East and North Africa now?
It's a pretty wonderful thing to see. I mean, it really is. It's, you go down, I mean, I'm just thinking now when I got there in mid-February in Yemen. And, you know, again, these are closed societies. These are societies where the government has done everything in its power to to keep everything, you know, any hope of a better future or ideas of a better future or ideas of a different way to live away from the people. And here you had, you know, I remember when I landed in Yemen, I landed at the airport and drove straight to Sana University. And here are, you know, 22-year-old kids who are, you know, fighting and in some cases dying for all the things that, you know, that we believe in, you know, for democracy and the rule of law and for freedom of speech and press and those things. And it's incredibly inspiring. I mean, to see somebody like Tawakkol Karman kind of, you know, rise out of this and to be able to articulate a democratic vision as well as anybody in the West is remarkable. And it's so inspiring to see. And I think what's also been so clear, and particularly in a place like Yemen, you know, the leaders just, they're stunned. They're just blown away. They don't know how to react. You know, they're like, this never happened before. And one of the things I did when I was in Yemen was I had gone to one of these rallies that Saleh had, one of these pro-government rallies. And, you know, they're bizarre spectacles. And I went and looked up, as you can do, just to remind myself, on YouTube, you can find the old video from 1989 of the Romanian dictator Ceausescu going out. And this is, I think, probably just a couple of hours before he's executed and his government is overthrown. He goes out on the balcony, you know, out into the square, you know, whatever it was called, the Victory of Socialism Square, and the giant crowd is out there, as he had done, you know, 1,000 times before, and the crowd, you know, cheered him adoringly. And in this case, the crowd just starts to jeer, and you see Ceausescu's face just kind of collapse. You know, he can't believe it. And it hasn't quite come to that in Yemen, but you can feel it. You can feel it. The government just doesn't know. None of these governments know what to do. You know, they offer, you know, they dissolve their cabinet. They always do the same stuff. But it's incredibly inspiring. It really is. You can't help but be moved by it.
You covered the war in Iraq for years. And when the Bush administration decided to invade Iraq, many members of the Bush administration and neoconservatives who supported the invasion, like Bill Kristol, said that if we topple Saddam Hussein's government and help create a democracy there, democracy will spread through the Middle East. That didn't happen. Iraq is still, you know, trying to create democracy slowly, but there's still a lot of fighting between different factions in Iraq. It does not seem to have caused democracy to spread through the Middle East. Many people say it really strengthened al-Qaeda. But now, ever since Tunisia, that has spread through the Middle East. And I guess I'm wondering if you're comparing those two scenarios a lot.
Yes. Yeah, inevitably. Well, I think the first thing that's obvious, I mean, here you have these really thrilling, wonderful, inspiring, where the people are kind of rising up and saying, you know, enough. We're not going to take these repressive leaders anymore. That's just an amazing thing to see. And so, but the principal difference between, say, Yemen and Egypt and Iraq is, you know, one was imposed from outside, and the other, you know, bubbled up from within. And you can, I mean, it never felt like that in Baghdad. But the other thing, I think, you know, to credit whether, you know, it's George Bush or Bill Kristol or one of those guys, when George Bush asked the question, as I think he did, why should we assume that the democracy, that the Arab people don't want democracy? Why should we assume that? Well, he was right about that. I mean, when you hear people in the streets in Yemen, you know, 22-year-olds articulate what they want, it's a deep yearning that I think comes from people's hearts and souls, and they know exactly what they want, and it's basically the same thing we want. And so, in that sense, it feels universal. It really does, and I think they were right about that.
Well, Dexter Filkins, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Dexter Filkins' article about Yemen after the uprising is published in the current edition of The New Yorker. You'll find a link to the article on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.